Welcome, friends. I'm your host, Ron Jacobs, back again here on the ArtCast. You know, I think business is sometimes frustrated with IT, right? They're like, business is dynamic, it's changing, and the marketplace is competitive, and we got to win business. And IT wants to have things kind of static and fixed. They long for the good old days when they would write a COBOL application that would run for 20 years. And they're like, hey, can't we go back to that? But my friend, the world has changed. And our guest today is Steve Jones from Capgemini in the UK. And he has a lot of really interesting thoughts about how this dynamic of change can really be a factor in the relationship between business and IT. And how really, IT ought to be driven from the business rather than the other way around. So what do you think? Let's listen in. Here's Steve Jones. Well, I'm back. Ron Jacobs here at the Architecture Insight Conference in Wales, where I am joined by Steve Jones. So Steve, tell me about yourself. What do you do?
I'm Chief Technology Officer for Application Development Transformation, which is a ridiculously long title that basically means that anything that's not a package, you know, Dynamics or SAP and Oracle, that's the sort of area I deal with, how we should deliver new technologies.
Okay, and so I'm not sure what that means.
Exactly, it's a fantastic title. The basic one is that, you know, there's a fundamental shift going on in the industry at the moment, changing the way people deliver software.
Okay.
You know, the buy v build argument historically is, you know, you buy it or you build it. It's really changed now to buy and build. You buy some stuff and you're going to build other stuff. Stuff adds value, understanding how it does. And also the impact of service orientation that, you know, starts at the architecture level and therefore needs to drive all the way through the delivery process. There's no point service orientation just being about pretty pictures and PowerPoint if your delivery is still waterfall, off the cliff, big risk, delivers a blob, business doesn't like it. You know, there's no point. That stuff's got to change as well. So that's really what I'm about.
Okay. And so you're talking here at this event about driving IT from the business. What do you mean by
well,
that?
At the moment, a lot of organizations are sort of driven by IT. So, you know, the rate at which they can change is dictated by their IT. How they work is dictated by their IT. That's the wrong way around. The whole point here is that the business knows what the business wants and IT needs to deliver against it. There's no really such thing as IT strategy. There's just IT doing something that implements the business strategy. IT strategy on its own has no point. So when we're talking about driving IT from the business is how does IT understand what the business wants? At the moment, you know, we tell them they've got a system called Phoenix, Dave and Gerald that we need to modify. That means those names mean nothing. They're just the names of the code names of the projects that put the systems in place. What I'm saying about driving IT of business, we've got to start thinking in terms of the services that the business has. And one of the things about service orientation that came as a bit of a surprise to me when I started working with business people several years ago around it was they actually think about their businesses in terms of services. You know, they have finance. It's a service. They have procurement. That's a service inside finance. So that's the thing is that therefore we need to, in IT, be delivering IT that looks like the business rather than looks like a blob with a code name.
Aha. So, you know, it is interesting. Microsoft has this motion methodology you've probably heard about.
Yep.
I didn't know much about it until, I don't know, a couple months ago when I had the Rick Merrifield, who's our motion strategy director, came on my show and told me all about motion and how it works. And I was really amazed to see if you could break down the business in terms of these capabilities and these services and understand them from that perspective, how cleanly it maps onto service-oriented architecture.
Well, to me, I had several chats with Rick over the last 6 months or so, and you know, it is service-oriented architecture. You know, it's not even a mapping thing. Those are the services. That is where the service orientation starts. You know, it's one of those, you know, those are the business services. Those are the areas, the domains. Some of them are massively high level and IT won't implement it. Some of them are people things. But that is service orientation. That is thinking about the business and IT in the context of domains of control, to use, you know, different terms. But those are the services. So the motion type stuff in terms of, you know, capturing that information, then presenting pictures And pictures, everybody underestimates the power of pictures in these things. You know, people make comments like, oh, the picture, don't worry about that, the document explains it. The only thing that will live from that document is the picture. And that's what I really like about motion is, you know, it's got information and then it's realized that, you know, one of the important things is how do you represent that? The fact that you need to go out and buy a plotter that can do it in A0 might be a challenge for some organizations, but, you know, that creating the pictures is really an important part of it.
Well, and you know, this fits. If you can understand the business in that way, then it opens up a lot of interesting strategies for the business. You know, so one of the things Rick and I talked about on the ArtCast was how if you look at a function that's not core to your business, one of the things you might consider doing is you know, getting a partner or a vendor to take that service and do it because they can do it more efficiently, a little more cost effectively than you can. And so then you would need to understand where that service interacts with other parts of your business so that you can do the IT work that's necessary to outsource that function.
Yeah, I mean, we released into OASIS last year a SOA methodology aimed at the business capture side, defining those services. Really sort of like a three-stage process is services are what you do. So first thing is find out what you do. Next thing, find out who you do it with. And then find out why all of those things interact. What are the drivers for it? You can then categorize exactly like you're talking about in terms of, you know, what do we consider this service? Is it value-adding to the business? Is it just, you know, something we have to do because of legislation? Is it just utility, you know? Telecoms is a good example. It's just pure utility. No company in their right mind would go, we're going to build our own telephone network, unless they are a telecoms company.
Sure.
Right? So a lot of IT is exactly that problem. Is people are building things, and you go, why on earth is that core to your business? But IT at the moment, we don't have that granularity of categorization. We're talking about it in terms of big blobs and brand names. So we might say, oh, we've got Dynamics AX or we've got SAP. That is great. That's got nothing to do with the business service that you're trying to outsource. So understanding those business services, understanding the context, just simply, you know, what, who, why, that means you can start understanding how things can be changed and why those interactions happen. Because if there's no reason for the interaction to happen, then just don't do it. And it's amazing how often IT systems talk to each other, and then you find out there's no business driver for it. Somebody just thought it was a good idea to integrate them.
It's a solution looking for a problem.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, I think the businesses who are taking the step now to understand their business in terms of the services will be well-positioned to take advantage of the emerging suite of services that are going to exist on the internet, and in very low-cost services, but that yield very high value. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, rather than, you know, in the late 90s, we might have gone out and bought an enormous piece of enterprise software.
And then
a three-year implementation rollout plan and loads of customization to get something that would do everything we possibly would need. And many people who went through that process found in the end that the result wasn't nearly what they'd hoped for. But now you can, you know, it's conceivable that you could say, well, here's a service we need. It's not core to our business. There might be 5 or 10 different companies around the world that could do that for us over the internet. If we could understand how to plug that into our enterprise, we'll be well positioned.
Absolutely. And, you know, some of them might not actually be IT. That's one of the ones on the service stuff, is understanding, you know, some of those services. You know, it's important to understand the non-IT services as well. You know, so some of those things, you know, but we just need people to do it. Well, we can do that cheaper if we do it in a, you know, call centers, those sort of things. You know, they put them in Poland or India or China for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, absolutely, understanding those drivers and understand the categorizations. Really, it's a simple language as well. And that's one of the key bits about all the stuff, and motion's a good example, is that the pictures are simple. One of the challenges IT's had, and the big projects are a great example of it, we've created more documentation than, you know, the Library of Congress has ever dreamed of. And there's no value to it. But the pictures, that simplicity, is the level at which you can actually have an impact.
Well, in fact, you know, people have often assumed that more documentation is better. And so, you know, we have to justify our existence. And you say, well, what have you been doing? Well, you see that very large binder over there with all those pages. That's what we did. And it's tangible, but if it's not comprehensible, it doesn't help.
No, absolutely. And, you know, it is the simplicity problem, you know, which is always something IT's had a challenge with. And getting more of a challenge now. I mean, my background's originally in large-scale systems, air traffic control stuff, which is scary, big, complex stuff. Commercial systems are getting towards that challenge now. Now, worrying about cross-border, worrying about distribution, worrying about real-time events, and the rigor, which doesn't mean documentation, it's a different thing, the rigor and formalism that those projects have. Now, you're not going to put, you know, safety-critical formalism on your average commercial project, but the way of thinking, the first thing is, we've got to break it up. We've got to think about it simply. You need simple stuff. Most IT starts with, let's create a massive, massive document. And that'll explain how everything works. And the problem is that that doesn't explain how everything works, because it's saying nothing works, because like you say, nobody actually understands it. You've got to start with the simple, because actually that's how people communicate. Nice short words, not doing massive amounts of prose.
There was a study of some large-scale failures of projects. And it was funny because most people assumed that projects failed because of not properly understanding the requirements. And yet, in this one particular case, there was a system that was going to replace the air traffic control system in the U.S. You may remember this. It's a well-known failure. And after many, many years, millions of dollars spent, hundreds
billions.
Of man-hours, or billions, yes, actually, yeah, they produced a warehouse full of requirements documentation. But it was literally so much that no group of people could even possibly understand all of the requirements.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting one, is that if you look at the UK air traffic control system, which was in some ways not the ultimate success because it was late and it was a bit over budget. It was, however, the most complex air traffic control system ever built. The requirement definition stuff was still being done during development, but it had been broken down and put out to tender, and companies were assigned to it well before then because it had been broken down. I think it's a great example how the American system attempted to be built of how not to do it. You know, it was the ultimate attempt at waterfall.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is just a phenomenal goal. But people, you know, why waterfall isn't dead continues to amaze me. You know, it was a bad idea in the 70s, and here we are 30 years later. People are still going, oh, well, such and such didn't work. We're going to do waterfall. It's a novel thing, but yeah. We really don't learn.
Yeah, well, and I think there's just a recognition now, especially with people looking towards agile methods, that we can't perfectly understand everything before we begin.
Absolutely. I know. I'll get on a high horse here. A lot of the agile stuff, I worked on a project where we did obviously daily builds and things like that. We released a test every day. We released into production-esque type stuff pre-live every few months. And you know, we iterated on the requirements and did that stuff, but wouldn't have called it agile. You know, it was building an air traffic control system. You wouldn't want to take a punt on that in an agile process. We had 1,000-odd developers on it. It's quite big. To me, agile is a great brand to put on things. It's a great, you know, and we can do all these things. But actually, a lot of this stuff is just do the stuff you should have done, and the stuff that the Mythical Man Month said in the 70s that you should do, and that's traditional done well. And to me, it's the same with the service-oriented architecture.
Yeah.
You look at really big, good projects historically, and they had one. And all we're saying that people are branding it and going, oh, service-oriented is this big, shiny, new thing. No, it's not. It's good stuff that people are recognizing. Like object-oriented design started in the 60s. We then had arguments about what it was in the 90s before people started doing it. You know, same thing. We just repeat the mistakes over and over again. We then brand stuff as agile and say, ah, oh, this will solve the problem, and still make a lot of the same mistakes, but we've got a new shiny name on it.
Well, but you know, this is how we get attention, right? we invent a new brand name for something, and then we write a bunch of papers about it and have a big conference, and that's how we get our work done.
I think it's in part how we get work done. It's also how we avoid the questions. Uh-huh. You know, we say, oh, well, yeah, we had all those problems before. It's all right, we're doing Agile next. Oh, okay, then business doesn't know what you're talking about. Oh, they're doing Agile. That's going to fix the problems. In the last few weeks, I've actually heard phrases like, oh, we tried Agile, it didn't work, it just highlighted all the problems too early in the process. Wow. There's a real stuff, you know, people, oh, well, we were doing Agile, but we didn't do the unit test because it's just about getting the coding out. So people brand stuff, yeah. And there's people who do Agile well, and mm-hmm. they're good. They probably do what I'd call traditional, iterative, release often, test first, which are all things that aren't Agile invented. They do that well as well. You know, it's again, good people do good stuff.
Yeah.
And how do you control people who aren't at the level? I mean, it's not talking about bad people, it's talking about the average people. There's more average than there are good.
Well, you know, that, now that you mention that, I mean, a lot of the test-driven development kind of approaches were things that the company I worked for in the 90s, early 90s, was doing in Silicon Valley, you know. And we had, in our build process, of course, back in those days, I was doing build on a 386 machine. And it literally took all night, you know. Oh. You would leave your desk and start the build, and you come in the morning, and it might be done.
Yeah.
But it would build and run a full regression test across that build, and you know it was great. Mm. And I was, you know, when I first started seeing people talk about, oh, we're going to do test-driven development, unit testing, I thought, haven't we done this before?
Yeah, and you know, a lot of IT, I mean, it is this sort of shiny nickel stuff, and that's to me why the SOA stuff is really important. And things like linking in things like, you know, the OASIS reference model type stuff around SOA is really important, is that it's defining what good looks like. And it's saying this is what these things are. And it's also trying to shift people's mind, because what tends to happen is we go around in these little circles all the time. We do the same thing over and over again. And you know, one of my measures is if going to an organization and you can read the mythical man month and say, right, you're making all of these mistakes, that's probably not the stage to worry about whether you're doing Agile, you're doing RUP, or you're doing Waterfall. You've got some pretty serious problems before you get there. You know, you're still not doing the basics well. And we hide not doing the basics well because we don't define what good looks like.
Yeah.
So, you know, in the service-oriented world, there needs to be a definition, which is, you know, for me, the OASIS reference model, SOA reference model, of what good SOA looks like. What are its principles? What are its practices? So you can say, that is good, that is bad. At the moment, the only real measure we've got on projects is project success, and that's measured by a delivery date. It's rarely measured by the long-term impact on the enterprise that it has, because by then everybody's buggered off and done something else. So the fact you've done all of this fantastic coding, you've reset live, it's really complicated, and then you hand it over to somebody who goes, I don't understand this. That's fine, your project's a success, and you're on to the next thing.
Yeah.
You know, we don't define what good is, and we have no formal way of measuring what good is.
You know, so this SOA reference model, I don't know anything about it. So I'm curious to know, what is the SOA reference model?
There's a group inside OASIS. It's a public draft now. So anybody who wants to put in comments, it's now's the time to put in the comments. Basically set up predominantly by non-product vendors. In fact, pretty much completely by non-product vendors. So people actually have to use SOA in the field, rather than people who think web services are a cool technology. Uh-huh. And it's really about defining the principles of SOA. And it aims to define SOA not in terms of, you know, it's web service, it's this, it's that. It's in terms of, right, this is what a service is. A service is a way to access capabilities. Brings together a provider, a producer, and a consumer. That's what it does. A service-oriented architecture is an architecture based around those principles. And it defines all of the terms. You know, there's all of these things. Everybody at the moment has a definition of what SOA is. It's like the RPC world was before CORBA. Yeah. And then, okay, we've got DCOM as well, so we had two. But now we've gone down to actually having one. But before COBOL, we had like 58 different RPC models. Right now, we've probably got 3,000 different definitions of what SOA are.
Right.
You can, with the SOA OASIS reference model, you can say, well, actually, that's one. Let's pick a standard. It's a good definition. If there's issues with it, let's make changes to it. But there's no point ever reinventing their own definition of SOA. You know, whether they're a company like Microsoft or they're their own company, you know, a small mom-and-pop shop doing stuff, there's a definition. It's one of those ones where, like 802.11b, people can argue about there's better protocols to do wireless. Yes, there are. However, we've got one, it works, and we can all understand it. Let's do that. Same thing I say on the SOA reference model. We've got one, it works, let's use that rather than all trying to invent our own one.
Well, it, at least this gives us a common point of understanding.
Exactly.
So we don't have to spend the first 10 minutes saying what we mean by SOA.
Exactly. And at the moment, you know, it's that sort of, you know, some people say SOA is web services, which, you know, to me is just a complete anathema because that's technology. That's not architecture. That's that's like saying that a building is brick. You know, what is building architecture? It's brick.
Yeah.
No, you know, it's not. But that is the thing. So this really talks about it in the abstract sense in terms of it is architecture. So we've got a starting point. There's lots of other things to be done, but we need to. It's one of those ones we love inventing the wheels, and there's nothing we love in IT more than inventing the same thing as somebody else, but we think our way's a little bit better. I mean, pre-UML, I mean, you had, you know, Ivy Jacobson here, you know, obviously Grady Boost, Rumbar, you had Bondo, you know, there were lots and lots, Schlemmer, you had lots and lots of methods basically doing exactly the same thing, which is what UML was all about. You know, in the same way as with UML, there's no point everybody defining their own way to define a use case. We've got one, thank you, let's just use that. There's no point with SOA, everybody defining their own thing, when we're trying to understand what the damn problem is. If we don't understand what the problem is, the SOA space, because we're all speaking in a different language, we're not going to move forwards. We're going to continue to go in that nice little circle that we always do.
Well, and of course, one of the things that drives this is there's the whole community of thinkers, whether they are, you know, informal thinkers like bloggers and mm-hmm. And whatnot, or formal thinkers like analysts.
Yep.
And then the vendors, who are all trying to stand apart from the crowd, right? So if everybody else is saying pretty much the same thing about SOA, one of these guys will stand up and say, well, I want to stand out from the crowd, so I'll say, I don't think it's SOA. I think it's ESB.
Yep.
And then everybody says, what's ESB? And we're on the whole train all over again.
Absolutely. And the thing there is a lot of those ones get driven by technology. And that's just the shiny nickel type stuff, you know. We've had enough of doing IT badly with new technology. I think we can safely say in IT as an industry, we've pretty much got that one down pat. We can do things badly in any new technology that gets invented. Any new term, any new approach. I mean, enterprise service bus is a good example. It's like people talking about one ESB across an enterprise. We learned with EAI, you never end up having one integration solution across your entire enterprise. You end up with lots. And if you don't plan to have lots, you have real issues. You know, ESB, people are talking about exactly the same things that when people talked about EAI didn't work. Have we learned? No, of course we haven't. We're going to try it again because it looks good in PowerPoint.
And it has different letters.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, yeah. You can imagine some of the product vendors in the integration space clearly just went, you know, backspace, S-B. There we go, we've got an ESB. And it's the same thing, and we haven't learned the lessons even something that only happened 5 years ago. It's not like we're asking something complex, like to remember what happened, you know, the fact that Waterfall died in the 70s, but we keep reviving its dead corpse. You know, this is something 5 years ago, and inside people's companies, they found out they would never have a single enterprise integration solution. And yet, we're now saying, same people are saying, but we are going to have a single ESB.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Absolutely.
Wow, well, this is... This is fascinating stuff. So now I have something to think about. I have to go download the reference model and read it on the plane, because SOA has been one of the things that I've sort of been looking at for a long time, and I was always kind of perplexed by the different takes that people had on SOA. Mm. And you know, it seemed to me that people were kind of going around in circles with what they were trying to accomplish with it. So, Anyway, I just look at it and just say, well, this is, it looks like madness to me, but I'm trying to make sense of it, and so maybe this will help.
Yeah, I think the SO reference, it's actually a pretty well written document, and it's one of those ones, you know, people say, you know, things defined by committee, you know, and always get slighted. Actually, defining things in a committee when you've got people who actually understand the problem is quite good. Again, you know, 802.11b, those sort of things, those standards bodies. You wouldn't have the industries that exist without those standards bodies. So yes, somebody could come up and, you know, have a shiny nickel version and say this is better, and we can go and keep going down that road. But it's a good good document to read. It's got a great glossary. I mean, I go into organisations where, you know, they're trying to create their glossary for all the different terms. There's already one in there, so use that as your starting point. And you know, it's a good explanation of what good SOA looks like. It doesn't tell you how to do it. That's the methodology stuff we released last year into OASIS via the Adoptions Blueprints group. That tells you how to do it. It's about what does it look like and what is it.
Great. Well, I look forward to reading that, and thanks for joining me, Steve, on ArtCast.
Cheers, thanks very much.
Stephen Jones, ladies and gentlemen, from Capgemini. You know, I was talking to some guys later, you know, they were saying, oh yeah, we went out to the pub, and Steve, and he was really great. We were just going at it, you know, they were having a vigorous debate at the pub. How geeky is that? You know, you get a bunch of architects in the pub after an event like this, and you just go, wow. Hey, but I just want to give a shout out to Chaz, who's been listening. He sent me a nice note, said, great show, man. He wants me to do a show on multi-threading. I thought, wow, that's pretty interesting. So I thought, well, who would be the guy to do it? Well, how about Jeff Richter? Huh? I've been talking to Jeff. We're working on a plan. We're going to try to get it together. Who knows? In a month or so, maybe we'll get that together. Send me your suggestions to ron.jacobs@microsoft.com. We'll see you next time on ArtCast.